Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXXVI, Spartacus, brackets 1960, close brackets. Spartacus is an epic historical film based on the life of a Roman gladiator who led a slave rebellion against Rome in the 1st century BCE. In this episode, we'll take a fond look at this cinematic classic in memory of its leading man, Kirk Douglas. Here's Rhiannon Evans. From a classicist's point of view, from somebody who researches Roman history and teaches it, what does this movie mean to Roman historians and to the genre? And tell me about that perspective of the movie.
I think it's one of the important epics from that period, and there were quite a few a lot in the 50s and still some in the 60s that we sort of look back to as encompassing modern versions of Roman history. And there's recently been a lot published on what the films do with that Roman history, how they package it up, how they're dealing with contemporary concerns. And Spartacus, what's often said about it, and I think quite rightly, is it appears in 1960. It's very clearly right in the middle of the American Civil Rights Movement and various other kind of movements for change and a more progressive society. Mm. And here we have a film about a character who led a slave rebellion. So a slave rebellion, obviously an important analogue for the civil rights fight, written by somebody who'd been blacklisted by the Committee Against Un-American Activities, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so therefore, at the very least, had an axe to grind and certainly had a particular ideology in mind. Ideology makes it sound negative, but, you know, Dalton Trumbo, the very famous Hollywood writer, his name was not going to appear on it. And in fact, it was Kirk Douglas who demanded that he be identified as the writer of the film and in a great part responsible for breaking the Hollywood blacklist. So it's kind of got a mythic status as a film. And I think it's also one of the most important films about Roman history.
Mm-hmm. But it's impossible to watch without looking at that lens of contemporary politics in America at the time, almost, that you've got those two central themes to the movie, both playing out in society at the time, I suppose.
It is. And actually, this time around, I hadn't watched it for quite a few years. And just watching it again at the weekend, I realized I'd forgotten. There are moments in it where I think it's also playing with contemporary gender debates. There are small moments where you think, oh, that's kind of, you know, it's looking like second wave feminism there. Like the first time, almost the first time we meet Varinia, and Spartacus says to her, "I'm not an animal." Mm-hmm. And she says, "Neither am I." Mm. Like, she's very assertive about that. And at one point, there's an older woman who the rest of the slave rebellion are sort of disregarding. And she says, "No, I'm going to fight too. We've got a part to play in this."
That's right. I can do black magic and everything like that. I can, yeah. And Spartacus kind of picks her up and dismisses her and literally sets her aside.
But then in the battle at the end, there are women in the battle.
I saw that. There are, yeah, and children. And yeah.
Yeah, it's children just, too. It's kind of terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I was very aware of this being about a slave rebellion, you can't not be aware. But I had forgotten about the part that women have to play in the film. So apart from Varinia, there aren't really any central female characters, but I think that there's still a strong female presence in the film.
Mm-hmm. So shall we just basically skirt a bit around? We're not going to go through and analyze this point by point and go, they got this wrong, they got that wrong. I mean, you know, it sticks a bit to the history books, but it really kind of doesn't stick to the history books. And it doesn't try to at all.
But can I point out a couple of the things that stuck in my throat every time and I annoyed my husband with by saying them over and over?
Wow.
The garrison of Rome.
Yeah.
The character Glabrus, who's based on the Roman politician, military figure Glaber, he is given as a present from Crassus, played by Laurence Olivier, the garrison of Rome. He gives him this kind of medallion and he's now going to be the leader of it. Well, garrison of Rome didn't exist.
Mm.
All right. And it explicitly breaks the rule of not having troops in the city.
It does.
Unless you're celebrating a triumph. So very special circumstances. Why they had to make it the garrison of Rome he was in charge of, it's just makes no sense. And then that position is handed over to Caesar or offered to him towards the end. So they keep playing on it. They keep bringing it up. It annoyed me no end. Okay, one more thing, if I can have one more anachronism.
Before we even wade into the plot, but okay, yes.
Okay. Varinia. British slave.
I noticed that.
73 BCE.
Before Caesar even goes over there.
2 decades before he goes there. But they're not going to be slaves until the conquest, surely, in 43 CE. So that's 100 years too early. There could have been. There could have been Brits hanging around. But we are told by Plutarch, I think, that she is a Thracian.
He's also the only one who even mentions that Spartacus was married, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right. Yes. There's a wife who is with him in Capua and then I think, on the rebellion too.
And it's just a footnote as well.
But then most of our historians don't give us that much information about Spartacus. That's part of the problem.
So we should say, just as background material, guys, there are 3 episodes which we did on Spartacus, maybe last year, maybe the year before.
I think it's at least 2 years ago.
Look, it can't be that long because I'm still remembering things about it. Okay. So, you know.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, those are there which are on the historical Spartacus and, you know, our normal Emperors of Rome motif of going through the sources. So that's there for background. And we're not going to nitpick this.
We're not going to talk too much about sources here.
But having said that, let's just go through some of the broad things. Like, I like the opening scenes where Spartacus is there mining. He's a slave who is mining. And that is one of the most common occupations that a slave had in Rome was mining. And one of the most dangerous ones.
One of the most common and definitely the worst.
Yeah.
Going to get back to anachronism very briefly. One of the things raised about that scene is that it's said at the beginning that he's been a slave there since he was 13.
Yes.
He probably would have been dead by
40,
or I don't know how we're meant to envisage him, maybe somewhere in his 30s. They didn't last very long at all. They were worked so hard.
Yeah, it would have been quite a rough living.
We don't have any evidence that Spartacus ever served in the mines, though. We get different snippets from different sources. Certainly we're told by one of them that he was a deserter from the Roman army.
So he might not
have even started off as a slave. But obviously for the purposes of the film and its trajectory to be about more recent slavery as well, he has to be born a slave. Plutarch tells us that he is more Greek than a Thracian, which is a compliment from Plutarch. And that means he almost certainly wasn't illiterate.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So his kind of humble circumstances are probably emphasized in the script and in the film. Almost a bit of a simpleton. And I guess more pure because of it. So there's a sort of dichotomy set up, isn't there, between the Romans who have all of this knowledge and power and wealth, but are corrupt. And his sort of spiritual purity, that he can lead this movement because of that.
So as we wade into kind of like the gladiator school and what's going on there, do you think that Kirk Douglas was well cast in this movie? I mean, he definitely...
Well, he cast himself. He's the executive producer.
I know that. And he was very much the driving force to this movie. And I believe that it was because he got turned down for the role of Ben-Hur.
It is said that he wanted the role of Ben-Hur. So this was kind of his alternative Roman epic.
Yes, yes. And they came out a year apart as well. So 1959 for Ben-Hur, 1960 for Spartacus.
It is also probably worth noting that at the same time there was another Spartacus movie in production. So this film is based on the novel of Howard Fast. There's another novel by a man called Koestler called The Gladiators. Yul Brynner was trying to make that film.
Yeah.
But this movie beat them to it.
Right.
And that does mean that the production was a bit hasty because they wanted to get there first.
Yeah.
And it was also beset with other kinds of difficulties. So not everyone agrees with me, but I like Kirk Douglas in this, and he kind of is Spartacus for me.
He was okay. I think he was, as far as the movie goes, all the scenes I think were stolen by the Romans.
Ah, yeah, that's interesting. So the baddies, mostly the baddies.
Yeah.
Well, certainly Laurence Olivier is a bit of a scene stealer. Yeah. He's playing Crassus. Yeah, I mean, he's very evil. I suppose he's made more complicated by his apparent love for Varinia, which I'm not sure I bought for a moment.
It came out of nowhere.
Yeah, it did a little bit.
Yeah.
I like Kirk in it, but as I was saying, as executive producer, he also had a big hand in what was happening, you know, how the direction the film took. And apparently there was a lot of argument between him and Trumbo, the screenwriter, and Kubrick. It's very famously known that he did not like this film and he kind of almost disowned it.
Well, he was 32 years old, so he's very young. It wasn't his first motion picture, but it was, you know, one that he's strongly associated with afterwards. And he also wasn't the first director.
No, that was Anthony Mann, who did direct the bit in the mines at the beginning.
Mm.
So that's kind of his part of it. And Douglas got rid of him. He didn't think he was up to the epic movie, although he made very epic movies afterwards, including El Cid.
And I found some behind-the-scenes videos of the construction of the Gladiator camp and everything, which we will get to. Anthony Mann is the one directing how it should look and how it should be built and put together and everything like that. So he's still involved at that point as well. So, but, you know, clashed too much with the star slash producer. And, yeah, Stanley Kubrick brought in. Very quickly, you get the appearance of, is it Peter Ustinov?
Yes.
What a scene stealer.
As Batiatus, a real person. He's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
He won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar.
Yeah, one of the few Oscars. I think this movie won four Oscars, and that was the only acting one. And I get the impression that a lot of his lines weren't scripted.
Oh, maybe. He
seemed to be ad-libbing quite a lot.
Something that I could clearly envisage him doing.
Yeah,
and of course, he's doing this in the wake of having played Nero in Quo Vadis in the 50s.
Oh, okay.
So he's got form in Roman epics.
He would have been really good. Yeah.
And he is one of the highlights of the film, I agree. And the way that he's largely a sympathetic character, but also he's in charge of a slave school, of a school of gladiators.
In Capua.
Yeah. And he's rich. He kind of seems to rule over the guy under him.
Marcellus.
We're told that he regularly kills someone just to make an example of them.
Yeah, and to keep all the others in line.
Yeah, yeah. Batiatus presumably could put a stop to this and doesn't. Nevertheless, he comes over as this sort of jovial character who in the end will help Varinia to escape.
Oh, he's paid a lot of money to do that.
He is,
We ask
he's grasping, and he's also a toady when Crassus is around or anybody of the aristocracy.
I've got a feeling that they made that part bigger because of Ustinov, because he was doing such a good job. He was seen stealing so much that I could see that happening. He is a historical figure. He was Spartacus's owner and at the Gladiator School, which was in Capua. So they stuck to that.
They did stick to that. So that is one of the parts of the film that is correct.
Mm.
So let's talk about the Gladiator camp.
I really liked it. That was, the best part of the movie.
Yeah, and I think it's generally agreed that that's the case.
Because
what happens afterwards was beset by all kinds of difficulties. But obviously, the part in the camp is the part that plays most strongly with that theme of the civil rights movement. Because you've got Draba there as such a strong character.
Played by the former football player Woody Strobe.
Mm-hmm.
My interesting fact about him: Woody Strode's final feature film was The Quick and the Dead, which co-starred fellow gladiator Russell Crowe.
It all comes full circle.
It does.
I did not know that. Thank you for telling me that.
There you go.
I can bore people with it.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, not a zombie movie.
No.
So, civil rights.
Yeah, so I guess it's the scene I know best because it is one that I show to my students, because it really pits a black gladiator against a white gladiator, but they're forced into this. It's like the system represented by Laurence Olivier playing Crassus and his horrible gaggle of right-hand men and the two horrible women who demand this fight to the death. They're forcing these people into conflict.
Yes.
So we think of both of them as good. And you know, we've had kind of this very tense build-up where Spartacus's efforts to get to know his fellow gladiators have been rebuffed because, as he's told, I might have to kill you one day.
Yeah, well, that was specifically by...
It was Draba who tells him that.
And I
don't know if you enjoyed this, but the part where they're not the first pair who were put out to fight each other, I think that's a masterful move.
It was Crixus and somebody else.
Crixus kills another gladiator first, and they're in this sort of enclosed, it's like they're in a little shed waiting for the doors to open, so they get thrown out to fight.
I like that because it built the anticipation, because going on outside.
You don't see much of the fight between the first two gladiators, but you see Spartacus and Draba having
sizing
to sit there waiting.
Up. Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
it's very tense.
Yeah.
Well.
And it was an interesting touch for the movie as well, not to have Spartacus win that fight with Draba. It was Draba who won but made the decision not to kill Spartacus and then essentially just go for Crassus.
I've read various kind of analyses of that whereby it said that, you know, politically, you can't have Spartacus die at that point anyway. I guess you could have had Draba kill another white gladiator, but that would have been difficult to put on film in 1960, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
But politically, they didn't want the black character to be overcome by the white character, because this is a film about that kind of has in the background the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
So you're right, they kind of stage it quite cleverly in that Draba has the upper hand, but he refuses to kill Spartacus, and instead he tries to kill Crassus. So he tries to get at the root of the problem, the Roman state.
Mm.
And then he is really brutally killed. That was one of the parts of the film that they tried to censor out. And I think at one point it wasn't in the film.
Really?
Where Crassus sticks a knife in him and the blood spatters over.
Yeah, yeah. Just the simple
clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it also falls into that cliche that the black character is the first to die in a film.
Mm.
So while he's portrayed as very noble and extremely brave and really trying to hit the root of the system, he's also the first one to be got rid of.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, look, I think it was a good turn, really, all things considered.
After that, you weren't as impressed with the movie, I get the impression.
No. Look, I liked The Breakout as well. Thought that was quite good.
So Breaking Out of the Gladiator School.
Yeah, yeah. The thing about these old movies is when they have the big scenes like that, if they were doing that now, a lot of that would be CG. Post-production, but now they just, you know, they had to do everything.
Yeah.
And that's just what's so overwhelming about the scale of this movie sometimes is that all of it's got to be done in person.
I agree. What we see of the battle scenes for that reason is, and they went to Spain to shoot that.
Some of it was a painting, I think, but...
Oh, there's painting involved, certainly, especially with the scenery, and I felt that was at times the most clunky element there. But yeah, you're quite right. The fact that everything has to be of the action, it all actually happens.
Yeah. So there was a scene during The Breakout where Spartacus drowns Marcellus in stew. Mm-hmm. Essentially just dunks his head in and really holds him down. He broke the actor's jaw then. By smacking him against the pot a bit too hard.
Okay. I hope he was appropriately compensated. Because he plays evil pretty well, that guy.
Yeah.
It was appropriately brutal. That's what they needed to do to escape.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, I think, it was a point of contention in the production for the rest of the movie. Quite how brutal was it going to be? How realistic was it going to be? So I think we can talk about that when we finally get to, you know, he forms a slave army.
Yeah.
They have to fight.
Mm.
Early on, this is an important scene, they come back to the gladiator school. I guess that's where they're hanging out at the beginning. That's where they're living. Spartacus kind of wanders through and he sees where Draba had been hanging. There's still just a rope there and it's all empty now and kind of destroyed.
Yeah, I thought he was going back to, you know, kind of find the body and give him a proper burial, but it's just an empty rope.
Mm.
And he goes into the old cell where he saw Varinia and gets a bit nostalgic maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything else was hugely achieved in that scene, but it was
he goes back up and his fellow gladiators, escapees, notably Crixus, who's one of the few named ones, who was a real person in the historical accounts we have of this, a Gallic ex-gladiator. He's putting on a show of two Romans that they've come across and getting them to fight to the death.
That's right. And so that's when Spartacus could make a big stand and go, no, look, we are better than them.
Yeah. So this is obviously mirroring what Spartacus and Crixus as well have been put through.
Mm.
That's really ideologically important because that says that Spartacus is going to have a kind of pure revolution where, yes, you know, it's the... I don't know, they go low, we go high kind of motif, isn't it?
Well, they've got to make him a moral character.
Yeah. It does actually speak to a lot of the arguments that were going on in the background because Kubrick wanted to make Spartacus a much more complex character who is eventually corrupted by his position as leader of an army. Right, he has to make compromises. He has to be brutal at times. And Kirk Douglas was not on for that.
Right, okay.
So that's kind of the scene that makes that mark, makes that difference. And it is also the one scene that seems to refer to some of the ancient sources and actually the novels both have. They have a moment where Spartacus and Crixus break away from each other. And Crixus kind of goes off and has a breakaway movement.
Which happens in the historical
documents. Some of our historical sources refer to that, that they have different aims in mind. In fact, one of the things that was flagged in the script, or one of the versions of the script, it went through various ones, was that Spartacus would have this disagreement with Crixus over what their aim was, and that he would have to make an example of him so he would actually have Crixus crucified.
Yeah,
so that did not happen. That's not in the film.
Yeah, I know.
But it was, he didn't miss it. It was raised as a possible way for the script to go. And instead, Crixus dies in battle at the end nobly.
Mm.
That puts it out. Spartacus makes his point. This is the way we're going to be. We're going to be morally pure. and everyone gets behind him and decides that's the way they're going to go.
Mm. Something that we skipped over earlier, and this is me gushing again over Ustinov, is that when he was buying slaves right at the start, when Spartacus was at the mines, he gets offered a Gaulish slave and he goes, oh, no, not Gauls, too hairy, which I think was a vague Caesar's Gallic War reference.
You know what? I didn't even notice that. That's terrible. You're absolutely right. They're from hairy Gaul.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, it hasn't been conquered yet.
No, but still. I think that was a sly reference to Caesar's Gallic War.
I think you're absolutely right. You know what? I think you're going to have to watch Quo Vadis because if you love Ustinov, he's never better.
There was another scene when the two ladies were picking out what gladiators to fight to death, and he clearly doesn't want his good gladiators offered.
Yeah, he's trying to point them towards the useless ones, which I thought was quite realistic because he's really shocked when they want to fight to the death.
Yeah.
That's going to waste his highly trained gladiators.
Yeah, of course.
And we think that was probably the case, that they didn't have many fights to the death.
Yeah, yeah. I completely see, but, you know, there's at one point where he goes, oh, how about that gladiator there? And she goes, no, 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 that's way too short. And he goes, oh, of course, but he's not that short. You know, optics. I completely think that was ad-lib.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that line.
Just
yes,
as he just drops it in as they're walking around. And I just, there were a couple of points in this movie where I just had to hit pause and just sit there and laugh. And that was one of them. There was one other which was just so bad that I can't believe I laughed, but I just found it hilarious. And that we'll come to it later on. Anyway, so I think that now we should talk about the Romans and the Senate and kind of lump a bit of that together, because there's kind of three big chunks to the movie. One is up to the gladiator school and the outbreak, and that's an hour. Mm-hmm. And then you've kind of got all the stuff that's happening in Rome, and then you've got the rest of Spartacus's, I wouldn't even call it a rebellion, whatever you want to call how that.
It's called the Third Servile War by the Romans.
Yeah,
so
well,
you could call it that.
So should we chunk it like that? So talk
yeah,
about...
although it's cut into two by an intermission, of course, which is where I broke off and went and had my ice cream.
When we reach that point of the podcast, we'll play the intermission music, okay? Let's talk about Rome. To backtrack slightly, Batiatus?
Mm-hmm. Well, they pronounce it like that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they pronounce it Batiatus, but I'd say Batiatus.
Okay, so Ustinov's character
yep.
had a bust of Gracchus, and so I had to hit pause and go, that's a very realistic bust. I wonder if, you know, that's from a museum or something. And I spent ages Googling Gracchus because I know Gracchus, and I didn't realise that that was a fictional character. And then he's turned up in the Roman Senate, and I've gone, oh, there's 20 minutes of my life gone.
It's Charles Laughton. That's who the bust is of.
Okay, so fictional character.
He is, and clearly meant to embody some kind of spirit of the populist politician. So the one who's going to, I guess, hand the baton on to Caesar.
Yeah.
Although Caesar kind of flip-flops in the film in a way that's not very...
I don't think he should be in the movie, but I know they wanted the name drop.
Yeah. The real contrast is between Crassus, who, in very broad terms, represents... I mean, he actually uses the word patrician. That's
yes.
what's used of him. So I guess what we now, the Romans themselves, optimates. The side that represents the power and authority of the Senate.
Mm.
And they give him this extra dimension, don't they, where he loves Rome. And they use all of this kind of sexualized imagery of it. He loves Rome like a mistress, you know. And then Gracchus, who seems to derive a lot more... He's sort of slightly corrupt. He's bought the Senate over to his view. He seems to have the Roman people, their interests at heart in some way. And in fact, in one version of the script, he goes over to Spartacus. So that was mooted as a possibility.
I'm trying to see how that could work.
And I think possibly it would make more sense of the way that he frees Varinia at the end, that he's on their side at that point. What's in it for him? Like getting back a Crassus, I guess.
He did that to get back a Crassus. And there was at one point where it was made explicit that he was the one who was arranging for them to escape from Italy. So he was making sure that the pirates' ships could take him away.
Yeah.
So I can see how if you wanted to take the next logical step that Crassus is so much his enemy that he goes over to Spartacus. But even then...
I think there are some aspects of that version of the plot left.
Mm.
And in a way, they don't make as much sense anymore without that very clear definition of whose side Gracchus is on. I think people's motivations become a bit clouded, and I think that's to do with the versions of the script and what they cut out.
Can I just say that by that point there was so much that didn't make sense that I was just fine with it?
What was it that didn't make sense to you particularly?
Spartacus's whole plan?
Yeah.
Slash lack of?
Yeah. But then, you know, we're not clear on what his plan was, I guess, from the ancient sources. Mm-hmm. But I won't go into details, but there are writings on this. And I've been using this excellent book edited by Martin Winkler called Spartacus Film and History, which people should get hold of if they want to read more. And that has two really good chapters on the production and all of the fights over the production, the ideological fights, and also the fights with Universal Studios, who were really worried that it wouldn't make its money back. So they cut a lot of the very violent scenes out of it.
Yeah.
They wouldn't, I think, didn't even get to shoot some of the battle scenes they wanted to shoot.
How about the scenes in the Senate? Did you like what you saw as a Roman historian?
The shape of the Senate was all wrong, but I think it's based on a painting. The Senate House in Rome now is not the one that was around at the time. But it's a square building, and the building at the time would have been of a similar shape.
Yeah.
All right, but the one we often see in paintings and therefore in movies is sort of almost more like a lecture hall. So it's got that semicircular form with the seats sort of in theatre style on a slope. That is based on a famous painting of Cicero berating Catiline.
I think that painting has influenced a lot of how people see or visualize the Senate.
Absolutely. So it's by an Italian painter called Macari, called Cicero Denounces Catiline, is from 1840. It has exactly that shape of the Senate House. In fact, the seats are exactly the same.
Also a statue behind whoever was speaking on the Senate floor of the wolf with SPQR.
That features in so many films, doesn't it? I mean, it is the Capitoline wolf, it's known as.
Yes.
Which had little babies put under it in the Renaissance.
Yeah, didn't see any babies underneath that, which is good. Yeah, it's just the wolf.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure it features in Gladiator, features in the film Titus. I've seen it in other films too. In that position behind the emperor or in the republic, whichever senator's talking.
Can we talk about what was originally a scene which was edited out of the theatrical version and dropped around here, which is snails and oysters?
Oh, yeah. Famous scene.
Whoa. So Crassus is there, Laurence Olivier, getting a sponge bath from Antoninus.
Played by Tony Curtis, complete with New York accent.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a bit. And he alludes to... No, he doesn't even allude. He just
says, do you prefer snails or oysters? Do you eat snails? Do you eat oysters? It's a thinly veiled kind of, which way does your sexuality go?
So the whole snails and oysters scene was originally cut out of the movie, wasn't it? So,
yeah, it was seen as indecent.
Yeah.
That it was far too suggestive. I suspect that people who weren't already very aware, it would have passed over their heads. I know you don't think that that's possible, but back in 1960, I bet it was.
It was pretty clear what was going on.
I mean, in my mind, in the very next moment, you saw Antoninus running towards Spartacus's little gang, but it's not quite as...
No, he leaves...
Not quite as fast as that. He leaves while Olivier's talking.
Yeah,
right? he turns around and he's not there.
He leaves off camera, but
and
that
is... And it's true, the next time you see him, he is with Spartacus.
Yes.
You don't actually see him fleeing over the hills. I'd inserted that part in my head.
This scene was edited back in the 1991 restoration.
But they didn't have the audio anymore. So apparently Anthony Hopkins had to do Olivier's voice. Tony Curtis comes back and does his...
So they've redubbed the scenes then. Okay.
It with Hopkins playing Olivier, and I did not notice when I watched it.
Yeah, no, neither did I. I didn't either.
So he's clearly a great mimic.
What do you think of the Roman houses? Can we just talk kind of collectively about the decor that they've got here for the villas?
There's a lot of bath scenes,
as we've already
indicated, which I guess tallies with what we know that the Romans use that as one of their leisure pursuits. They're going for, I noticed in, I think it's Gracchus's house, he's got the Villa of the Mysteries paintings painted on the walls.
So he does,
it's a very famous house from Aplontus, and they've just kind of put them in there.
They've Googled Roman mosaics, whatever came up.
Wall paintings, yeah. I mean, it's quite a weird and explained. It's called the Villa of the Mysteries for a reason. Nobody really knows what kind of weird ritual's going on in it. It involves some figure with an angel and somebody being whipped with a bare back.
There's an episode of When in Rome on that with Gillian, if people want to track that down.
Of course, yes. You've talked about it in When in Rome. I mean, they were quite elaborate for the late Republic, but we do hear ancient authors talk about how wealth is amassing. And so there probably were relatively luxurious houses at that point, certainly villas, some in Rome, but a lot of them maybe around the Bay of Naples. I would say there's probably a little bit more glamour there than there might have been, especially for someone like Gracchus, who's meant to be a man of the people. Would his house have been quite as elaborate?
He's got so much money. He gives Ustinov at the end, you know, 2 million sesterces to take a slave away.
On the other hand, he is clearly about to kill himself. He doesn't need it.
Here, have another sack. Yeah. Shall we talk about the slave rebellion parts and the segue into the battle scenes and what have you? Mm. It shows you a lot without showing you a lot.
Yeah, I feel that that's the least successful part of it. And some of that is to do with these behind the scenes fights that were going on about how the rebellion was going to be characterized, whether it was going to be a complicated situation where the slaves didn't live up to this vision of freedom that they had. And this goes back to the novels themselves.
Yeah.
Or they would have actually made a great society and of freedom and egalitarianism. Because you see a lot of these scenes of them looking kind of happy together. It's very folksy, isn't it? They're singing or they're dancing.
Like a great army of extras, lot of kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody kind of working towards the same aim.
Yeah.
And really what overcomes them is just the weight of the Roman army. There's too many of them.
Mm.
There was a behind-the-scenes fight going on as to whether they would have that version of it, which kind of plays better into Spartacus's character, or whether they'd start to disintegrate themselves and that would play into their defeat.
Yes.
So this is part of that ideological battle as to whether revolution breaks down because it becomes corrupt, which is what we might say did happen in the Eastern Bloc, or is it that capitalism is just too much for it in modern terms?
Yeah.
They get ground down by the more powerful and already corrupt force of the Roman Empire in this case.
And there were a couple of really strange decisions as well. Like, it's clear that the slave army spend a lot of their time walking across Italy, raiding the countryside, taking food, taking lots of riches. You know, a couple of times Spartacus shows off how much money they've got to buy the pirate ships, quite a lot of money. And there were a couple of scenes of people just gleefully giving the
handing
riches.
It over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there'd be one or two clearly rich Romans who were being made fun of. But it was no more than, you know,
There was one lady who ran up and, I assume, beat up her husband for handing over some of the riches. But all in all, everyone seemed very happy to.
There was no raiding going on. There was no rampaging.
There was one raiding scene, which was early on in the slave rebellion kind of thing that they did show, but it was like kind of really brief. But after that, it was just all, we will clap you through the streets kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're gleefully coming out and contributing.
Yeah.
And running down the hills towards the slave encampment to join up. It very much has this narrative of there's a momentum that it looks like it's not just slaves joining in, but anybody who's poor, anybody who's needy, or anybody who believes in the cause starts joining up with them. And yeah, it does become this little community. It's shown as more of a community than an army, in fact, isn't it?
Yes.
As an analogue to that, we don't really get much of the battle scenes, which were planned at some points and are often mentioned. They mention that Spartacus has had 9 victories over Roman armies, but we never really get to see much of that.
Well, the big one that happens off camera, I suppose, was the defeat of Glabrius. Is that his name?
Glabrus.
See, yes. I couldn't even remember his name properly. Yeah. What a surprise. Matt got a Roman name wrong. But okay, so the defeat of Glabrus.
Well, it's not his name. His name's Glaber in our ancient text. So
that happens completely off screen. And I remember this this scene, perhaps in Plutarch, of a Roman officer being essentially caught without his pants on while he's bathing in the river by Spartacus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, why didn't they slot that sort of thing in just to, you know, show him winning over something? You know, easy ways to show Spartacus having a victory.
Certainly the victory over Glabrus is played more for the way the Romans treat Glabrus afterwards, that they're ashamed of this and that he hasn't been up to the job. He hasn't set up the encampment. He didn't put fortifications up, which I think was a way of covering the idea that the Romans underestimated Spartacus, certainly at the beginning. So it sort of worked from that direction. But yeah, I would have liked to see that. And I think Kubrick wanted to put more of that in.
Instead, all that we essentially saw was Spartacus going into the camp at night with all his guys and capturing Glabrus and then just telling him to go back to Rome.
Which, again, was him being lenient.
Yeah, tail between your legs.
Yeah.
It skipped over a big battle scene by doing things vaguely at night.
There seem to be various reasons for that, partly cost.
Fair enough.
And partly not to make it too bloody, because some of those early cuts... There were some cuts that happened in a re-release in 1967, and some of that was cutting out more violent scenes.
Mm.
Back then, it was considered really dangerous.
So shall we discuss the actual battle scene that you do see, the quite big one towards the end?
Yeah, so the main battle we see is the one where he's defeated.
Yeah, okay. All right. But besides that, it was pretty impressive, the amount of extras that they had involved in that.
It is. Although, as I've been reading, there should have been 8 legions. They talk of 2. So it should have been even more.
Yeah.
But, of course, they couldn't get that many.
No. And I'm pretty sure part of the Roman troops in that was a painting. Like all the ones in the far distance were a backdrop painting.
But they have some pretty impressive choreography going on where they move around.
Mm.
Again, it's anachronistic because it seems to be based on a 2nd century BCE formation and it's out of date by the time we get to the Roman forces at the time of Spartacus. But it looks great.
Look, it did seem way too much pageantry. But if you've got that many extras there, goddamn it, you're going to use it. So the rolling the burning logs doesn't happen.
No.
Yeah.
Some of the trenches of the Roman encampment.
Sure.
But it's quite a good tactic.
I thought that was impressive looking. I don't see how it would work properly, but it's still impressive.
I thought that the people rolling it were going to come to grief, but they seem to just end up in the melee.
Yeah.
It's really impressive, and it's probably unfair to Spartacus, although we don't know much about his tactics. We know he did defeat Roman armies. Then he probably wasn't in charge of this. They sort of looked like a rabble, didn't they? They were just in a mass, whereas the Romans were very regulated and they were tightly formed and they looked like they'd been trained.
I mean, they're slaves and gladiators.
I guess you could say that he wins on guerrilla tactics. So maybe the open battlefield, not so great for him, at least as far as the narrative of the film goes.
Yes, that's right. The victories I remember of Spartacus was, throwing rocks down Mount Vesuvius and those sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At that point as well, he's caught in a pincer movement, I guess, between Pompey's army. They mentioned another army.
Lucullus. Yeah, they were on their way, but they were a long way away.
Yeah.
So they've sort of speeded up the action there, I guess, to make it less of a victory for the Romans in a way, because they were just overwhelming numbers. So what probably happened is that Spartacus knew that the other armies were coming, but they're in, Spain. They've got to come all the way from Spain or wherever.
Mm.
So he wanted the battle to happen quickly. And from Crassus's point of view, he may well have wanted to get it over so that he could claim the victory and the spoils wouldn't go to Pompey.
Yeah.
The idea that there were these other armies that then arrived, it's not the case.
One particularly bloody point in the fight there where Spartacus chops a guy's fake arm off, which was quite good with the spurting blood. Yeah, like that. Appreciated that. Really kind of gory and poignant stuff about, dead bodies just lying there on the field and a crying baby.
It's quite an emotive point, wasn't it? And I guess, again, reminds us that this was a community fighting together, not like a Roman army that's sort of away from the civilians.
Yeah.
There's no differentiation with Spartacus's group. They're all in it together.
Mm.
So that means that if you defeated, then those kinds of people are the victims. They're just left.
Mm.
They're either dead or they're going to be taken back into slavery.
Very iconic scene. I'm Spartacus. Everyone's standing up and saying that, which Kubrick hated. Really hated. Did not want it in there.
I guess it is kind of on the nose. This is spelling out that we are a group and we will all identify together.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a bit Borg-like. They're all Spartacus.
I thought it was great. I thought it was really good.
It is. It's been much both parodied and copied and, I think we should be glad it's there.
Mm, mm. And we should kind of say that, as far as the historical sources all say, Spartacus died in that battle.
He did.
Yeah.
So in a way, the role that's given to Crixus at the end, who does fall in the battle, is more what happened to Spartacus. Well, we think his body was never found.
Yes. But captured slaves were crucified.
6,000
on
the Appian Way. I'm not sure that it was done in the very best way, but I sort of like the fact that at the end, again, we got remirrored that pairing up and fight to the death.
Between Spartacus and Antoninus.
Antoninus, yeah. In this time around, they wanted to kill the other person from mercy, because the other possibility was crucifixion, which is a very slow death. So they're both trying to spare their friend the horrible death.
Yes, yeah.
But of course, Spartacus is stronger.
And at that point, the movie goes on for another half hour too long.
Yeah, I have to say, in my memory, there was only Varinia holding up the baby and saying, this is your son,
there's a half hour
free.
Stuff. Yeah.
Now we have a lot more discussion.
Yeah, no, I like the stuff with Gracchus. I think that was all good. I would have liked to have, if you're going to ham it up way too much and put in stuff that's not needed, I would have liked to see young Caesar, Crassus, and Pompey standing under the body of Spartacus working out their first triumvirate. Mm-hmm. Why not just take it that one step further?
Well, Pompey's not even there.
No.
I mean, it doesn't happen for a while after that.
Doesn't matter. Are you really worrying about that at this point?
Despite the fact that I agree with you, there's too much talking at the end, and even Peter Ustinov can't save that, or Charles Laughton. It did leave me feeling very sad, which it was meant to. In that final scene, it is desperately sad. She's free and her son's free, but they have to leave Spartacus there to die.
Yeah, I completely didn't buy the romantic storyline through the movie.
It didn't affect you.
That last scene redeemed all of that story.
Oh, okay.
Even at that point, I was going, oh, that makes it all worthwhile. That was a very moving scene of her holding the baby going, look, he's free. This is what you always wanted.
Mm-hmm. But, so what he's fighting for is the freedom for all of those slaves. And what he gets out of it is the freedom of this one child.
Yes.
So it's kind of, this is a little bit of hope at the end, I guess, is the message.
Very little bit of hope. Never a slave rebellion again.
No.
Yeah.
Indeed not.
No.
But the beginning of the film lays that bare, doesn't it? It's going to take 2,000 years for this to happen.
Oh, what was the deal with the heavy Christian voiceover at the start?
I see what you mean about that now. It was, there was the in the year of our Lord.
I wrote it down. I was just so kind of, what's going on? In the last century before the birth of the new faith called Christianity, which was destined to overthrow the pagan tyranny of Rome and bring about a new society, the Roman Republic stood at the very center of the civilized world. It was really
heavy-handed.
Heavy-handed.
And seems inappropriate for the rest of the film.
Exactly what I was going to say.
I would say, if I had to guess, and I'm sorry, I haven't read this anywhere, but I suspect that there is something written on it, that was imposed by the studio. That's my guess from the other reading I've done and the kinds of things that they were interested in, you know, forcing onto the film.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'd be very surprised if Kubrick was happy with that.
I guess the thing is, you know, it's voiceover, so that's easy to be dropped in at any point. And if the movie wanted to be heavy-handed with the Christian symbols, it could have done because, you know, Spartacus was crucified.
Yeah. But apart from the voiceover and the fact that he's crucified at the end, I guess he is a sort of messianic figure.
It could have been a lot, you know, Ben-Hur.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ben-Hur, the novel is called, subtitled A Tale of the Christ.
Yes.
So it's really there. Whereas
there on
Spartacus,
the book jacket, yeah.
Spartacus is clearly, it's a movie based on a novel that is about 20th century.
It's the original Sword and Sandals epic.
It's like my dad told me about the Beatles. You should hear what we had before.
So why do you think, or don't you think, that this is a movie that people should watch if they want to learn about Rome?
Well, I think that the first third of it is really important in showing us maybe how the lives of slaves and gladiators might have worked out. More to the point, though, it's iconic film. And for one thing, you might understand more of what goes into Gladiator if you've watched Spartacus. So I'd say Spartacus and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that that plays into Gladiator. So it's worth watching both of those.
Monty Python's Life of Brian. Yeah. Go for that as well. History of the World Part 1, dare we say? Mel Brooks. Oh, my God. Next podcast. But okay, so it's one of those iconic things. So you watch the first third for Slaves and Gladiators, you watch the rest of for Kirk Douglas.
I guess so. Yeah, maybe so. And
Peter Ustinov, of course. Yes.
And Tony Curtis.
Yeah.
And Laurence Olivier. And Charles Laughton. And I like Gene Simmons. But I don't know. I think the final thing we should say is, wale Kirk Douglas, and thank you.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, as always, they are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we begin our look at the last of the Severan dynasty, Alexander Severus. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.